I wasn't sure. Did the electron spin thing make sense? The electron is going this way, and it's also going this way. And that's what Pauli figured out.
And were they, are they all spinning in the same direction?
No.
They can spin either way?
Well, the big phrase is that what Pauli discovered was called the Pauli exclusion principle. L-E or A-L?
L-E.
Pauli said, determined, that these things exist in pairs. And that if there's an electron that's going this way, there cannot be another electron going this way until there's an electron going that way. That make sense?
Say that again.
No. Here we have, you know, imagine we have a couple of orbits.
Oh, okay.
We have an electron here that's going that way.
Uh-huh.
It cannot be that there's another electron here going that way. The other electron has to be going that way.
Hmm. Okay. Okay, so as these electrons come out of the nucleus, they shoot out.
No, they don't come out of the nucleus.
Oh, okay.
Out of the atom.
Out of the atom. They come out, they shoot out, and so as they do, then they would know that they had to, so they would just automatically go into the right rotational pattern.
They are in this rotational pattern.
They already are when they come out.
They already are in that thing. So they got, in other words, they thought, let me try this. I don't know if this will help or not, but let me try it. Okay, tell me how to find that. Okay, suppose, let's do this thing. You go somewhere in the room.
What?
Go somewhere in the room.
Okay.
Now tell me, I'll look down so I don't know. Tell me how to find where that marker is.
Well, are you in the nucleus with positive?
I'm Gary, actually.
But that was that marker. Are you the atom?
What? No, I'm Eve.
We like that.
I'm the electron.
Okay.
No, that's the electron.
Yes.
He's the electron. I'm the observer.
I'm the observer.
Okay.
So you're in the nucleus?
I'm...
No.
I'm
Eve.
Yes,
I'm going to find
it. No. Find the exit door.
No. Just tell me how many steps to go.
Oh. Where? Okay. Walk straight ahead. Keep one, two, keep going, keep walking. Straight ahead.
A little more to the left.
See, you've given me three directions, was my point. You've told me how far to go straight,
okay.
How far to go left or right,
okay.
How far to go up or down.
Up or down.
So any point they thought originally could be determined by three measurements,
right. Okay.
Or by three values. So to locate it, to locate any point in space, you needed three coordinates. And that explained things until they put the darn thing in the magnetic field. What Pauli says, you need four coordinates. Because you also have to know whether that thing is spinning to the left or right.
No.
And if it's spinning, if the electron is there spinning this way, there cannot be another electron in its orbit, actually in its energy level, spinning the same way. It has to be spinning the opposite way.
That's what it means to exclude.
Once an electron has a certain position defined by a coordinate and a spin, there cannot be another electron with that spin in that energy level.
And that much is predictable.
I guess you could say that much is predictable, yeah.
And the electron knows which way to go.
And it's like the electron knows which way it's going.
It's just a balance. It's creating a balance
that may not be
balanced.
Right, exactly. So you can see how Pauli's dreams would pick up on this. Because he was a very unbalanced guy.
So do they both come out at the same time? Are there more than two?
Yes. Now you're getting beyond my knowledge here. If I remember from chemistry, Cal, maybe you can help me here. I think this orbit can have two electrons, and I think this can have eight electrons.
No, sure.
And this, I forget. Each orbit can have a certain number of electrons, and that's just the way it is. So, if this orbit would fill with eight electrons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You'd have half of them going this way and half of them going the other way, rotating. So they actually have a different energy value, these different rotations. That's why when they come shooting out of the atom in the form of or their energy comes shooting out of the atom in the form of light. But you get these teensy little lines that are almost the same, but are kind of different.
So then could they predict if on that outer orbit you already have the amount of electrons available to that orbit? Can they predict then where the others that shoot out will go?
No. Okay. This is the rub. You can predict the probability of where they will go, mm-hmm. but you cannot predict where they will go. This is the twist.
It also says that in the presence of a magnetic field.
That's what I said, yeah.
Okay, and then without a magnetic field, is it different?
Without a magnetic field, the energy difference is so slight between these two, you get one band of light. And so, they were playing around. So when they first figure out, they say, we got this figured out. Look how we can compute these values of light by our electron model. And then some last guy got the idea, let's put a magnet in here. It changed. And that threw everything off. And that's what Pauli worked on. I don't know if you care, but it was called the anomalous an adjective form.
Oh, anomalous.
And the anomalous Zeeman effect. Because Zeeman is the guy who put the magnet in there. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's a story, speaking of stories, that Pauli was walking around one night. Somebody ran into him in Copenhagen and he said, how are you? And he says, I'm terrible. I'm depressed. And the guy says, why? He says, it's that damn anomalous Zeeman effect. I mean, that's how he was into it, you know. Let me just say what I've just said in a slightly different example to drive home the main point. I do care that you understand the science, but I'm really concerned that you understand the science to get to the principle behind it. And let me express the principle behind what I've just said in another metaphor, or another example, and that's radioactivity. Now here it's not the electron, but it's the neutron. You know, you've heard movies where they're going around the Geiger counter. Tick, 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 tick. The weird thing about that is the time between those ticks, one of that tick measures is when one of those atoms is decaying. And from the nucleus now, not the electron. Don't worry about that. It's the tick idea I want to get across. And that, there's no way to predict when those ticks occur. But if you average them out, it is so accurate you can make a clock out of it. It varies like 1/1/1 gazillion of a percent in a gazillion years. So each individual event is unpredictable, but the average is absolutely predictable. That makes no logical sense. But again, it's the same with the atom, that where that electron goes, what kind of light it emits is utterly unpredictable in the single event, but on average can be very accurately predicted. That's how they pulled quantum physics back into respectability, because it is actually a very accurate tool. But philosophically, they were all sensitive enough to realize that the essential nature of matter is not what we thought, and therefore is the essential nature of life not what we thought. If matter isn't predictable, why do we go around developing theories to try to predict things? And certainly then we can apply that to psychology. And you notice in Jungian psychology, we don't work with cause and effect. We don't treat people as billiard balls who get hit and then we try to figure out why they're going where they're going. We treat people as excited electrons and try to see what are the probabilities of going here and here and here and help them get there. The cause of the event doesn't determine the result of the event in quantum physics or in human beings. Although you've got a whole industry out there telling people it does. And it doesn't.
Did they give you, or is it in here and I missed it, that when you say on the average is predictable, but how many numbers did they use to come up with an average? What was their end? How many data points did they have to average out to find it?
Again, the technical details are beyond me, but a lot. I mean, if you measure millions or hundreds of millions of events, I think that's when it becomes utterly precise.
Okay, absolutely.
So, you know, when you hear it talk about the half-life of uranium, that's on the average. That's the average. And that, can be measured very, 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 very accurately. But then each decay of a specific atom is not predictable. I mean, it's weird. How can that be?
Mm-hmm. When they invented the bomb, did they split the atom? Is that how that happened?
Let me see. I'm not sure I know the difference between the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb.
I was just wondering, because if it's unpredictable,
they did not know how much it was going to be released. But you see, there, I think what they're doing there, the atom bomb is about the nucleus. We're talking about the electrons. But see, the atom, the physics that made that came. This is like 1927, and that physics was like 1945, so the ideas had developed. We're just getting at the very start of things. I think what happens in the atom bomb is they shoot a particle into the nucleus, and the nucleus erupts. And that eruption of the nucleus triggers a particle within the nucleus to shoot out and hit the nucleus of another atom. And when that one shatters, a particle from that nucleus shoots out and hits another nucleus of an atom, and that shatters. And then it just keeps on going. That's what a chain reaction is. First, you break one nucleus, and then they keep breaking others nearby. And that's related to what we're doing here, but again, remember the scale is, if this room is electron orbits, that nucleus would be a pin
head in the center, or maybe even a pinpoint in the center. That's why that was so hard to achieve. It's, I think I've heard it said, it's like hitting a golf ball in the middle of a baseball stadium with a marble from the stands. I mean, it's that technically that difficult to pull off. But the point I want to, you know, have, let you be with is what Pauli accomplished and how physics was developing, because we're going to be looking at that as a metaphor. Take this as a dream image. That's how we're going to be looking at it. Because he dreamed of it, it must also have a symbolic meaning. Yeah.
When you were talking about how when they threw the magnet in there,
yeah,
and then they didn't know what to do with it, what just popped into my mind, sort of interesting, you know, the Christ energy, when Christ actually came on Earth, was like that, was like a magnet being thrown into the world the way it was, and then no one knew what to do with that. Which way to go, in it, sort of a... And with Pauli and all this, to me, that collectiveness, that consciousness, it's all part of the shaker.
And interesting, the magnet is an image that you find in the Gnostics quite a bit. Okay. For God. Okay. Okay, that's page 7. Anything there that looks... Sommerfeld was Pauli's first teacher. That's page 7. I'm over at page 8. Anything on page 7 that you want to... Oh, maybe I could mention Pythagoras. Mm-hmm. Anything else there before Pythagoras? That should hopefully be clear. We can come back to this. So, you know, don't worry about asking me. Go over that again. I don't mind at all. Now we're looking at the, is there an archetypal dimension to the structure of the atom? Why are those orbits where they are? And, of course, we can't answer that question, but Pauli and Heisenberg speculated on it. Has that idea ever existed in history before? That there are built-in ratios. You see, there are predictable ratios in nature. They cannot be explained, but they can be identified. And they went back to the idea of the music of the spheres. Which is Pythagoras. In antiquity, Plato had the idea that if you could hear the planets, if the orbits of the planets were notes, they did know there were planet orbits. They didn't know exactly how it all worked. But Plato thought if you could hear the orbits, they would, as notes, that the universe would be a symphony. That there would be a pleasing quality to that sound.
Not cacophony,
that it would be harmonious. You see, these guys were struck by the fact, we would say projected the fact into, that there is a harmony among ratios in nature. And I think, you know, I'm not a classicist by any means, but I believe Plato was picking up, Plato didn't exactly use the word music of the spheres, but that was later what it was called. The first guy who picked it up was Pythagoras, and he was a what's called a pre-Socratic philosopher. He was a philosopher before Plato and Socrates, I think a couple hundred years before. And I think he lived in Asia Minor, if I remember correctly. And they were blown away by the fact that musical notes had mathematical relationships. So if you take a string, you pluck it, you get a sound. You get C. If you cut it in half and you pluck it, you get C again. It's an octave higher. And all of these notes that we feel sound good together have integer mathematical relationships if you measure the length of the string that plays them. And to the primitive mind, that was just awesome. And that was, in their mind, indicative that there was a built-in order to the universe. So first, Pythagoras and the musical relationship of harmonious sounding notes having an integer connection. Half, third, a quarter. I don't know enough of music. You know here, Kathy, but I don't know enough of music. A third and a second, all the terms. That they're never like a ratio 1.5 to 1. It's always 1 to 2 or 2 to 3. There's always an integer relationship. And they thought, why would it be that notes that feel good together have integer relationships? And for them, that was proof that the universe was numerically built, that numbers were mystical. Numbers were indicative of the qualitative nature of reality. So that's the reference to Pythagoreanism here on page 7. That they began to wonder, did those Pythagoreans have something to say? Is there maybe some numerical relationship to life? And we don't know what to do with that, but except at least at the moment to notice it. That why are these electrons related to each other by numerical ratios?
Well, it seems like modern physics is sort of heading in this direction. And they even Heisenberg uses that similar term that I mentioned last week. He talks about combining the mystical and physics. And he talks in terms of vibrating strings and what that could have to do with electrons.
Yeah.
Well, vibrating strings is the symbol they use now for the unified theory that would bring those aspects together.
Right.
So it's as though right now they are thinking along those symbolic lines of the mystical aspects of matter.
Right. I think to conclude, to give you an idea to take away from this, don't get so bogged down in all these details, but that there seems to be a pattern to nature that we have not yet understood. And it does seem to be a pattern. Why and what is its meaning, we don't quite know. But they were certainly struck by on the one hand, the randomness of events and the harmony of events.
They even talk about those strings in the same terms that Jung spoke of archetypes. Because they talk about the strings being the form through which matter is manifest.
Right. And I think, you could take what I just said and rephrase it in this way. Is matter archetypally structured?
That's what string theory is about.
Yeah. We know the human being is archetypally structured. Maybe matter is archetypally structured. Well, why should we care? Because what we're trying to do is find a way to knowledge which breaks down the subject and the object. Suppose the subject and the object are both made from the same form. Suppose the archetype that's structuring the self and the archetype that's structuring the atom are the same thing. We realize that if we press each point of view or either point of view to its extreme, we run into the other point of view. And that's what Jung and Pauli were working on. we can't draw conclusions at this point, but we can notice similarities. And this is trying to get us out of our way of thinking that science is objective. You can see it might be highly subjective. The structure of the world might be as subjective as the structure of our psyche. And by studying one, we might learn about the other, and vice versa. So that when a scientist is working both with their the external world and their subjective world, as Pauli was trying to do, we're going to have to deal with this possible convergence. That's the practical implication of all this. We go pretty far out, but then I'm trying to show us why it's important. And these dreams are going to be dealing with his understanding of time, for example. You might think, what a stupid, objective thing to be dreaming about. But he falls in love with somebody. And you know, when you're in love, time changes. He couldn't accept that. So his views of time affected the way he loved a woman. We'll be building those bridges. Okay? We've done two pages today. Page 8. Holler if you're not clear, but I think we've done it. Pauli's first teacher was Sommerfeld. And he was one of the guys who helped Bohr take those orbits and mathematically understand their shape, and then they began to be able to predict the colors that would come off of each element. That's what gave them proof that they were on the right track. And just for the sake of it, right here. Well, somebody asked me, why is the one line large and the other line small? That's the tube that's being heated on the left, and that's the light that's coming off on the right. If you didn't, that wasn't clear. Here's Sommerfeld. He was German, but, you know, like, not one of the fascist crowd. That's who Pauli studied with at first, when he went to Munich to study. And there he really became introduced to the quantum theory, which, so remember, he's still a student. And so Bohr was friends with Sommerfeld, and Sommerfeld was teaching these ideas, and then that's where Pauli learned about it. And what they were wrestling with at that point was this idea of the quantum of action. H, it's signified in physics. And today it's called Planck's constant, but here they're calling it the quantum of action. Planck's constant, like for Max Planck. The Germans pronounce it Planck, not Planck. P-L-A-N-C-K. It was first called the quantum of action, but later became called Planck's constant. So right where they were then was they were realizing there's some relationship between the discontinuity of energy and the electron rings, electron orbits, and they were trying to find a way to predict how that all looked. And then by 1927, the thing was finalized, and Bohr was sort of like the granddaddy. Here's a picture of Bohr. This is a very compassionate. Here's the young Bohr. A very compassionate and very likable teacher. As I was saying on page 8, they're just making the point about the fact that events have a limit to how small they can be.
And still be events,
right? And still be events, yeah. There cannot be anything smaller than a certain thing. And that was finalized in 1927. Page 8 to 9, electron orbits can be visualized, what I just said, like a solar system. That brings us to the exclusion principle. Does that look familiar? Everything in the text there look all right? If you have a question, I'll holler, but I think we've covered all that. It's just a matter of talking. The next point is what we were calling the defined structure, or the exclusion principle. I'm going to pass that around. You can see examples of lines that are very, very close.
That's where the doublet comes.
The exclusion principle says that no two electrons can have the same quantum number.
Do they usually call it the double phonon structure?
I think so.
Instead of the doublet phonon structure?
I don't know, Carol. What's that say there on that photocopy? Does it say? It might be doublet is one word and double fine structure is the another word. Could be. But just the point is to see what Pauli discovered.
They say fine structure.
Fine structure. Or maybe it's doublet and then fine structure. It's two different words.
Just say that again. No two.
Well, I'll give you the mathematical description and then we can see what it means in common sense. Actually, I think it helps to think about the mathematical definition. That no two electrons can have the same four quantum numbers. What that means is that to locate a particle in an electron, so to speak, you have three positions. Remember, how far over, how far up, how far across, and a spin. So if something is spinning one way, there cannot be another electron at that same place spinning the opposite way. Spinning the same way. It can be spinning the opposite way.
It must be.
I guess it has to, yes. Thank you. I never thought of it like that.
So it says here that the energy levels of the atomic electrons are affected by the interaction between the spin
right.
and the orbit. The angle of the orbit, it says orbital angular momentum.
Angular momentum is the energy in the spin.
Okay. So it can be spinning at a specific speed.
I think it is spinning at a specific speed.
And so if you have one going one way and the other one in the reverse way, are they both spinning at the same speed within the orbit?
Yes, right. I believe so. This is the edge of my knowledge, but I'm pretty sure. The idea is that they exist in pairs, and you can't have two of one. You have to have one of one and one of the other. And that explains why the lines are almost the same, but a little different. I mean, you can just think for a moment, we can anticipate it, but to try to keep this interesting. What do you dream of when you're about to become conscious of something?
Two.
One thing splits into two.
That's why I was wondering what, if two came out at the same time.
Yes, yeah. That's why there's two lines. The electron doesn't come out, its energy comes out. Okay. And the energy is almost the same, but it's a little different. So,
you give us, imagine a full circle, I'm just drawing out a circle. Electron, evolution out. Put an electric charge to it, which gives it energy. This electron gets excited and moves up here, maybe. So it's absorbed energy. When you take the source of energy away, this will seek its original state and will go back here. And in doing so, it will give off the energy difference between the two orbits, and you'll see that as light. And as I said, it may go here and go down, or it may go here, and then it may go here, so that what you'll get is a light here and a light here. That's why there are different colors in the spectral analysis.
So depending on the amount of energy that's expended in that moving from one to the other, you'll get specific light?
The color of the light is exactly dependent on the energy difference in these two orbits. Yeah. And the energy the light emitted from the energy given off when this electron goes from here to here or here to here will be the same amount of energy as it is here, but you'll have two different colors of light coming off, where here you have just one color of light coming off. That's how you get the different colors of light. And the big thing is, remember, you can't predict what's going to go top to bottom or first, you know, like fourth floor to ground floor, whether it's going to go fourth floor to third floor to ground floor. That's what you can't predict. That's the exclusion principle.
How long did that take him?
Pally? Yeah, I don't know what year they hooked up. Does it say in here somewhere?
The principle was published in 25,
but the question would be, when did he start working with Bohr? I don't know.
Tony Jomi in 24 had the idea of ascribing the Riemann effect to an unknown
process. Oh, here it is, page 8. From 1925, Bohr emphasized that atomic processes. Probably, I'm guessing a couple of years.
Copenhagen
when he was 23.
Yeah.
What do you got there?
It's a book called Men Who Made a New Physics.
Oh, that's a good book, by the way. Yeah.
Barbara Lovett Klein.
That's a good book.
It's pretty
story. Yeah. So you say he went 23.
He's 23 years old, so.
So 4 years.
Kathy, one short story.
Sure.
It's real
in his student days, he was in Sommerfeld class, Einstein came and visited, and after he had finished speaking, I said, after Einstein had finished speaking, Pauli in the audience stood up. You know, the teenager began, what Mr. Einstein said is not so stupid.
He was a tough guy to get along with. But Einstein loved him, I think. Go ahead.
Again, this book will say that he, at age 21, Sommerfeld said that he could suggest that he should write this entry in an encyclopedia, not quantitative. And Einstein wrote a note that he. Actually, reading this article helped Einstein understand that there is...
And when Pauli got the Nobel Prize in 45, he was in Princeton during the war, and so he couldn't go to Copenhagen, and they had a celebration in Princeton, and Einstein, in a public... who's there? Gave a public speech congratulating Pauli and said to Pauli, you are my successor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... well, that probably takes us. That may pretty well get through the chapter. The only other, page 10 we've talked about. Does it look familiar? What's written on page 10 and what we've said? The only other thing, which Carol I think mentioned, which we will pick up on later, is how Pauli went from saying that the electron. Pauli went from the people saying the electron needs three quantum numbers to saying there are four quantum numbers that are needed as a sort of parallel to the shift in the individual from three to four. That four is the big number. Not that important. What should you take away with this? One, Einstein's ideas. Time is relative. Secondly, what was the nature of the atom? What principles were challenged, basically the idea of predictability, and how did Pauli play a role here? He's the guy that solved the problem of the doublet, and that's going to be relevant because he'll be dreaming of it. And it's such a rich image in the dream when you dream of two of something. Trying to think what else, just as a summary. I think that's the main thing. Time and space have changed in Einstein's theory and in quantum physics. Causality is thrown out, and the irrationality of matter is something the physicists have to come to terms with. And then that's going to mean these guys start philosophizing. If that is the way we observe matter, how do we understand that changes the way we observe life? And then just to know a bit about what Pauli did do. I think they're the main points so far.
This is off, and I really don't know anything about it, but does chaos theory follow quantum?
That's at my limit. Carol knows more than that, more than I do here.
No? Is chaos just totally separate?
Well, it's not a atomic level. It doesn't have to be atomic level. It's a prediction of how randomness works in nature.
So
that there is a unifying factor in apparent random movement of objects.
So that's chaos theory.
It would apply, I think. No, I mean that there could be a pattern which we don't recognize or not.
I suppose that would be.
I think the classic is to think of that radioactivity, that there are random events, and yet they exactly have a predictable average.
I don't know if they apply chaos theory to the atomic level. I've only read about it in...
They do it more on the macro level, huh?
Well, yeah, applied to different effects in nature, like the way raindrops will cascade down a sheet of plastic or something like that.
That's all I read about it.
Maybe they do,
and it's try to apply it. Physics?
Yes, theory. Is it considered physics then?
Oh, I guess it would be. It uses physical principles of physics.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pictures that Gary Castle on the first book was a picture of Mercury.
Yeah, I'm curious.
On top of the world instead of standing on the veil.
one of those pictures.
Uh-huh. Mercurius would be the secret order in chaos. Absolutely. Okay, well, we eat one more time, and then we don't meet the 29th. One more time before the new year, I mean. Thank you for your hard work. I know it's not easy, but we'll get through it.
Yeah. Have a nice holiday.
Okay.